Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornielsen for the web version of STEM Spots. With me in the studio today is Dr. Robert Mijanovic. He's a distinguished professor and the head of the Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science here at Missouri State University. Thanks for stopping by, Bob.
Good morning, Dave. Glad to be here.
Now, Bob, you and I have talked many a time about physics is a major, about students coming into our major. We worry very much about things like this, and we're always talking about the difficulties we might have with that sort of thing. And in many cases, it seems to come back to a perception problem. So discuss what you see as this problem in perception that people have with physics.
Well, the problem that I see is really comes from a couple of vantage points. One is from students themselves. The students, I think, perceive physics generally to be about Einstein, theoretical physics. You know, you basically do pencil and paper type of work. And usually it's something very esoteric, perhaps about black holes or about the Higgs boson, things like that. The parents, I think, also have a perception issue. Many think that getting a physics degree is unemployable, which is definitely not true, and that it's also highly esoteric and not very practical type of degree to have.
Would you say that physicists are partly to blame? Because, you know, I was watching a show that was on a particular streaming service, and this show, of course, paints a group of scientists as behind a terrible plot, which is sort of the underlying theme of damn near every scientist that's ever been in any kind of a movie or anything. They're either weirdos that are off by themselves, or they're noble figures like Hawking. There was a movie about Hawking, conceivably. But many, many times, the vast majority of the times, they're just these people who are always plotting to do something terrible, many times involving tearing the fabric of space and time or some other nonsense like that. So is it partly the media and also partly our own fault that we constantly oversell the very esoteric parts because we think people are most interested in those?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's a fair assessment. You know, of course, the media is the media. I mean, they will do things that I think they perceive as making money for them. And obviously, that's going to be, you know, the perhaps more outlandish, if you will, aspects of physicists and science. I think the physics community has a share of its own blame as well. You know, I think the physics community could do a much better job in terms of educating the public and politicians, especially, for example, in terms of what physics does and how it contributes to society and so on.
I mean, think of some examples. I can rattle some off, but let's talk about a few examples that the things that physicists have done that maybe the general public doesn't know that was done by physicists.
Yeah. Well, for example, you and I talked about this several times. The physicists invented the transistor, which is probably one of the most useful devices in present society right now. I mean, if you pick up your phone or your iPhone, it's got transistors in there. And so, you know, physicists are largely responsible for being, for at least allowing for that technology to evolve.
Yeah, and I know what's interesting to me is I go out into high schools a lot, and I found many, many, many students who have never even heard the word transistor. Now, that's not their fault because it's not a word that's on everyone's lips. When it was invented, which was approximately 1948, in the decade after that, when it created the first miniaturization of electronics, it was on everybody's tongue. Now it's become sort of subsumed, and so what people talk about is just computer chip, not realizing that at the heart of computer chips primarily are transistors. Some other examples.
Well, for example, when I did my postdoctoral position, that's after you get your PhD degree, I had an offer to work for a medical instrumentation company. And it turns out that physicists are highly useful in medical instrumentation. If you look at the MRI, magnetic resonance imaging technology that's out there, that was developed by physicists. CAT scanning, also physicists. So we're very useful at being able to develop specifically targeted type of instrumentation, you know.
Let's rattle off a few more. So I'll do it because I like this sort of stuff. The laser was invented by a physicist. There were a couple of different claims to the invention of the laser, but one of them was certainly by a physicist. X-rays were discovered by a physicist. Of course, the MRI, as you've already mentioned, the transistor. And then one thing that people don't think of is that DNA, of course, to be determined to be the genetic material. People have obviously already been working on genetics before that, but DNA is the purveyor of the information. The structure of DNA and its role, the complementary nature of the two strands and all of that. Two of the people that won the Nobel Prize for that were physicists, which most people do not recognize. Right. And so if we take that right into the next thing, which is this whole idea of utility for jobs, many people might say, yeah, okay, you do some interesting stuff, but I need to work when I get out of school. So talk about that.
Yeah, so let me give you an example. You know, since we're talking about the kind of technologies that physicists are involved in and future jobs that we may think about, we can think about energy. You know, physicists are strongly involved in terms of being able to develop new energy delivery to society, whether it's solar energy or, you know, whether it's being able to take biomatter and harness that in terms of delivering energy, various areas like that. And so there, in the future, I believe you'll need physicists to be able to go into a field like that and work with engineers and chemists, perhaps, and other people to try and develop new industries that will benefit society.
I mean, one of the things that's always been a pet peeve of mine is that we're criticized for not having a lot of majors, which is true. Amongst the sciences, physics is traditionally the lowest, fewest number of majors. And yet, then on the other hand, sometimes people start talking about jobs and whether or not a degree leads to jobs. And then some of the people who shall be remain unmentioned to specifics, we'll talk about, well, people don't get jobs in our field, but we train a general ability to think, and they get jobs for that, a general ability to think. But in physics, we're not just talking about these people become trained to be analytical thinkers alone. Talk about the fact that the jobs out there in the real world specify physics.
Yes, absolutely. If you look at the advertisements from various different companies, you know, including Honeywell, Northrop Grumman, Intel, and so on, a lot of times they'll say that specific degree majors are desirable, such as math, electrical engineering, physics, and sometimes computer science. And so the physicists are right in the mix in terms of STEM type of positions out there.
So, I mean, the training is going to help people with analytical thinking, but it's also very specifically going to give them the kinds of tools that they directly need in an industrial setting.
Absolutely, yes, right. There are several tasks that are going to be important in being in an industrial setting, and a physics degree definitely prepares them for that.
Let's talk about, so for a long time, academicians were responsible for part of this, I think, that unless you got a PhD, you weren't really truly a practicing physicist. Right. But the fact of the matter is, most undergraduate majors do not go on to PhDs. So where do they end up then?
Well, they end up, as I mentioned a little bit, in companies such as Honeywell, you know, Lockheed Martin. We've had several students that work in that corporation, Intel, you know, Northrop Grumman. Lots of different companies that are usually tech type industries. You know, and when you talk about the fact that academicians have forgotten, you know, really where physics stems from, if you look at the history of physics, a lot of it really was from problem solving in terms of, well, you know, looking at heat engines and things like
that. Right, right. So, yeah, people forget that thermodynamicists actually were brewers. They made artillery,
right.
They built steam engines,
right.
And other kinds of things. And that's one of the things I think people forget is that physicists, as I tell people many times, are actually eminently practical most of the time.
Absolutely, right. I mean, what drew me to physics, really, was instrumentation, you know, being able to work with my hands and to be able to do science like that. And I think if you look at most physicists, that's probably true.
And what do you think the breakdown looks like? Because most people think of Einstein. He's the archetype, or perhaps Hawking or something like that. And they probably don't even know the name of maybe the more famous experimental physicists would be Faraday and Rutherford would probably be the top two. And, of course, Faraday invented and discovered the thing, the technique that basically is responsible for the creation of well over 90% of the energy in this electrical energy in this country, which is essentially the dynamo and the electrical generator. So how many people, when you break it down in your own mind, there's sort of we experimental people, and then let's call them theoreticians. What do you think that mix actually looks like?
It's highly skewed towards the experimental side, I believe. When you look at numbers some years ago, I don't have the current numbers with me right now, but it's probably at least 75% experimentalists and about 25% rest, which includes calculation, physics, people that do calculations and theory and so on.
Yeah, and when you say theory nowadays, that's becoming more and more dominated by the application of computers to massive problems.
Absolutely.
So, very few people are probably sitting at a desk with a paper and pencil in hand.
Absolutely. And you know, this is something that we've seen, for example, in the faculty in our department. We presently have two faculty in our department who are predominantly calculation physicists or
astronomers. So they're using computer programs.
Right, exactly.
Mostly because the problems are intractable by hand, either can't be done or it would take you an incredible amount of time, like 100,000 years to do.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's really fantastic in a way to be able to use computers nowadays to tackle these very difficult problems.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the things we do, and we'll talk more about this in a minute here in conjunction with our own program. But people, when I show them what I do, and I think you're the same way, they find it remarkable that my students have to learn how to spot weld. They have to learn how to hook up high voltage power supplies, and they certainly have to be able to turn a wrench. So talk about that idea that people can't understand that physicists basically put things together.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's one of the biggest hurdles in terms of people's reception is to realize that we're really very hands-on. Like you said, we use wrenches and so on to fasten ultra-high vacuum chambers, but you know, we also do very fine wiring, for example, and development of sometimes very highly tailored instrumentation that we need to have. And so students get a lot of really good practical experience and knowledge.
And I think the one thing that's interesting about that is, therefore, physics is broad enough to take on people. I mean, would you agree? I've seen students that I would say solving homework problems is not their strength, but put them in a lab, and that is their strength. Talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, when I look back and look at some of our students that we've had in the past, that's definitely been true, and they've been very successful. I mean, they've gone to industry and getting back to them, they obviously are having a great experience.
So in our own context, in the context of our own program, what parts of our program are going to give them this kind of thing? What do we do here at MSU? So
some of the things that we do is that we have a senior project where students have to work on an independent research project in the senior year. You know, some universities, they call it an undergraduate thesis project. And here, it's mostly hands-on. I mean, some students will do computational work, but the majority are going to work in labs. They work under the advisement of a faculty member. There's a committee that has to meet and evaluate the student's performance. So there's a lot of actual involvement by faculty in developing a student like this. Another thing that we do is we foster lots of internships that students can have with local companies or even companies that are somewhat not local, with the national labs. And those are very good experience for them as well.
Yeah, and we also push something called a research experience for undergraduates that the National Science Foundation funds. I mean, wouldn't you agree that every one of our students, we strongly encourage and work with them to do outside work that's practical.
Absolutely. And that's an invaluable experience, because if they go work in a national lab and they perhaps haven't even thought about that sort of possibility as a job, they definitely are sort of sometimes turned on to that. And we've had students that have ended up working in national labs by virtue of these experiences.
Now, in order to not make it seem like, well, now we're just practical shoe cobblers, not that there's anything wrong with that. Let's talk a little bit about some of the wide array of research projects people might do. So I know, for example, some people work on astroseismology with Mike Reed, where they'll actually look at the vibrations of stars because they're trying to study the interior structure of stars. And then talk about a project that you might have led that somebody might have done.
So some of the things that we've done in my laboratory, for example, is that we worked on nanostructured materials. You know, nanostructured materials are very important right now in terms of being able to develop, for example, devices that can pack a lot more information in very tiny spaces, as opposed to in the past. Dr. Ghosh, for example, in our department, works on similar sort of projects, but he's also worked on biofunctionalized materials. So, you know, he'll take these nanomaterials and then put RNA on top of that, because that can have a functionality that's different than just the bare sort of material.
Yeah, I know recently he just got some funding to do a COVID-related project along those very lines. And so there is, and then from a computational point of view, we might have somebody, we have a couple of different computational people. One person might be looking at the diffusion of some sort of materials in a nano particle of some kind or another, and then Dr. Sarah Morrison might be looking at the dynamical evolution of a solar system.
Right.
So there is still this broad range. I think that, I don't know how everybody else feels about their field. They feel their field is the greatest, but the thing that I love the most about physics is that it goes all the way from the esoteric craziness of black hole, wormhole kind of stuff, all the way down to the fact that at the heart of all of our electronics was a device invented by physicists.
Yeah.
Also.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, and I think that part can actually be a bit daunting for an undergraduate student.
That's true.
A freshman, right? Because when they come in and they think about, geez, you know, which area am I going to go into? And so this is why we've developed actually a course that tries help the students as soon as they come in.
That's a new course. Talk about that because you're right. One of the things about physics is maybe people have a perception problem and maybe they're just intimidated. So how do we try to bring these students in and get them up to speed?
Yeah,
what's this course look like?
So this course is called Big Ideas in Physics. We just started it last year. And, you know, the students have to take this course in their freshman year. And essentially what we do is we come in and talk about lots of different topics, including black holes, galaxy formation. We talk about superconductivity, on and on, all kinds of different topics that the students hopefully will get a breadth of knowledge in terms of what's out there. And it's not just a matter of mentioning these things for 5 minutes, for example. We have a lecture, a piece on these various different topics. So for 50 minutes, they may actually discuss black holes.
You know, one of the things that people also think is they think, and this happens all the time, not just in our discipline, they think physics is opening a book, reading the book, closing the book, and then you know physics, and then you've understood physics, and then you learn physics. But it's more like a process. So from my perspective, I see a lot of an apprentice kind of a process going on. So how do we try to get that kind of a thing going here?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think it is an apprentice process, and that involves really a hands-on experience. I mean, the students have to have close hands-on type of work. So one way that, for example, we do that in our department is through just students being able to work in laboratories. Well, either just as a undergraduate student.
Not necessarily as a senior only. But
not as a senior only, but they can come in at that sophomore level easily. And I've had students that have done that. I mean, that they're perfectly well-suited to do that. We do have internships, opportunities within the department where they actually do get paid for the experience. But regardless, that requires a great deal of hands-on. You have to teach the students how to come in and work in a laboratory, for example, how to handle equipment and how to turn the wrench and so on. Many students haven't done that.
No, it's not to be an old man about it, but people don't do their own breaks very often anymore.
Yeah, in fact, I found students have difficulty in remembering which way to turn, right or left, to tighten.
That's true. Well, there are left-handed threads sometimes.
Yep.
Well, Bob, thanks very much for stopping by. I want to also mention why don't you mention how people can contact you and the department if, of course, they have any interest in this kind of a major?
We do have a presence on Facebook, on Twitter. We're also on the web pages at Missouri State University. The phone numbers are listed there, email addresses, and you can contact us any which way you prefer to do. And so if you give me a heads up and you want to visit, I'd be happy to meet with you and to talk to you about physics.
Great. Bob, thanks so much for stopping by today.
Thank you.
And once again, this is Dave Cornelison for the web version of STEM Spots, signing off.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.